14. "We've got to get hold of Miss Rice," Hamilton said as the balance of the group filed up the front walk of the house and into the living room. "And then we've got to kill her, quickly and completely, without hesitation, as soon as we can physically reach her."
"She'll destroy us,"
McFaith muttered. "Not all of us. Most of us, maybe."
"But it would be better,"
Law said. "Yes," Hamilton said. "It would be a lot better than sitting here waiting. This world has to come to an end."
"Does anybody disagree?"
Arthur Sylvester inquired.
"No,"
Marcia said.
"Nobody disagrees."
"How about you, Mrs. Pritchett?" Hamilton asked. "What do you say?"
"Of course she must be put to sleep,"
Mrs. Pritchett said.
"The poor creature."
"Poor."
"This is the world she's always lived in. This awful, insane world. Imagine it year after year. A world of predatory horrors."
Eyes fixed on the boarded-up door to the basement, David Pritchett asked nervously,
"Can that thing get up here?"
"No,"
Laws told him.
"It can't. It'll stay down there until it starves, or until we destroy Miss Rice."
"Then we all agree," Hamilton said with finality. "That's something, at least. This is one world none of us wants to stay in."
"All right,"
Marcia said.
"We've decided what we want to do. Now how do we do it?"
"A good question,"
Arthur Sylvester said.
"It's going to be hard."
"But not impossible," Hamilton said. "We succeeded with you. We succeeded with Edith Pritchett."
"Have you noticed,"
Sylvester said thoughtfully,
"that each time it becomes more difficult? Now we wish we were back in Mrs. Pritchett's world."
"And when we were in her world,"
McFaith finished glumly,
"we wished we were back in his."
"What are you trying to say?" Hamilton demanded uneasily.
"Maybe we'll wish it again,"
Sylvester said,
"when we get to the next world."
"The next world should be the real world," Hamilton said. "Sooner or later we're going to be out of this rat race."
"But not yet,"
Marcia objected.
"There are 8 of us, and we've only gone through 3. Do we have 5 still ahead?"
"We've been in 3 fantasy worlds," Hamilton said. 3 closed worlds that don't touch on reality at any point. Once we're in them, we're stuck. There's no way out. So far, we've had bad luck."
Thoughtfully, he said,
"But I'm not so sure the rest of us live in total fantasies."
After a moment, Laws said,
"You smug son of a bitch."
"It could be true."
"Possibly."
"It includes you."
"No thanks."
"You," Hamilton said, "are neurotic and cynical, but you're also a realist. So am I, so is Marcia, so is McFaith, so is David Pritchett. I think we're almost out of the fantasy realms."
"What do you mean, Mr. Hamilton?"
Mrs. Pritchett asked, troubled.
"I don't understand."
"I didn't expect you to," Hamilton said. "It isn't necessary."
"Interesting,"
McFaith commented.
"You may be right. I'll agree about you and myself and Laws and the boy, but not about Marcia. Sorry, Mrs. Hamilton."
Pale, Marcia said,
"You haven't forgotten that, have you?"
"That's my idea of a fantasy world."
"It's my idea of a fantasy world, too."
White-lipped, Marcia said.
"Your kind of person..."
"What are they talking about?"
Laws asked Hamilton. "It isn't important," Hamilton said impatiently.
"Maybe it is. What's this all about?"
Marcia glanced at her husband.
"I'm not afraid to drag it out in the open. McFaith has already made an issue of it."
"We have to make an issue of it," McFaith said soberly. "Our whole lives depend on it."
"Marcia has been accused of being a communist," Hamilton explained. "McFaith brought up the charges. They're absurd, of course." Laws considered.
"This could be serious. I wouldn't want to wind up in that kind of fantasy."
"You won't," Hamilton assured him. A cold, bitter grimace touched Laws's dark face.
"You let me down once, Jack."
"I'm sorry."
"No,"
Laws disagreed.
"You were probably right. I wouldn't have liked the smell of perfumed soap very long. But..."
He shrugged.
"As it stands, you're wrong as hell. Until we can get ourselves out of this mess..."
He broke off.
"Let's forget the past and deal with the here and now. There's plenty of it."
"One more thing," Hamilton said. "Then we can forget it."
"What's that?"
"Thanks for pulling me up those stairs."
Fleetingly, Laws smiled.
"That's okay. You sure looked little and sad crouched down there. I think I would have gone down even if I couldn't have got back out. There wasn't enough of you there on that step, not with what I saw at the bottom."
Turning toward the kitchen, Marcia said,
I'll put the coffee back on. Does anybody want anything to eat?
I'm plenty hungry,
Laws said alertly.
I came directly from San Jose when the soap factory disappeared.
What showed up in its place? Hamilton asked as they moved down the hall after Marcia.
Something I wasn't able to figure out. Some kind of factory that made instruments. Tongs and pincers. Stuff that clamped like surgical tools. I picked up a couple and took a good look at them, but they weren't really anything.
No such product?
Not in the real world. It's probably something Miss Rice saw at a distance. Something she never made sense out of.
Torture instrument, Hamilton guessed.
Very possibly. I got the hell out of there, naturally, and grabbed the bus up the peninsula.
Getting up on a little stepladder, Marcia opened the cupboards over the kitchen sink.
How about some canned peaches?
She asked.
Fine,
Law said.
Anything that's handy?
As Marcia reached into the cupboard, the can slipped from its sack, rolled forward, and dropped with a sickening crunch on her foot. Gasping with pain, Marcia jumped away. A second can rattled forward, hung on the lip of the cupboard for an instant, and then dropped straight down. Twisting to one side, Marcia barely managed to avoid it.
Close the cupboards,
Hamilton ordered sharply, stepping forward. Without using the ladder, he managed to reach up and slam the wooden door shut. The dull bump of heavy metal cans striking the door was audible. For an interval, the sound continued, then reluctantly it died.
Accident,
Mrs. Pritchett said lightly.
Let's try to work this out rationally,
Law said.
It happens all the time.
But this isn't the regular world,
Arthur Sylvester pointed out.
This is Miss Rice's world.
And if this happened to Miss Rice, Hamilton agreed, she wouldn't think it was an accident.
Then it was intentional,
Marcia said faintly, huddled over and rubbing her injured foot.
That can of peaches.
Hamilton scooped up the can and carried it to the wall opener.
We'll have to be careful. From now on, we're accident-prone, with a vengeance.
At the first bite from his dish of canned peaches, Laws made a face and immediately set the dish down on the drain board.
I see what you mean.
Warily, Hamilton tasted. Instead of the usual blandness of canned fruit, his tongue was curled by an acrid metallic taint that made him retch and quickly spit his mouthful into the sink.
Acid,
he choked.
Poison,
Laws said calmly.
We'll have to be careful of that, too.
Maybe we ought to take an inventory,
Mrs. Pritchett said uncomfortably.
We should try to find out how things are acting.
Good idea,
Marcia agreed with a shiver.
So we won't be surprised.
Painfully, she put her shoes back on and limped over to her husband.
Everything with a life of its own, vicious and hateful, trying to do harm.
As they were starting back down the hall, the light in the living room quietly winked off. The living room plunged into darkness.
Well, Hamilton said mildly, there's another accident. Bulb burned out. Who wants to go in and change it?
Nobody volunteered.
We'll leave it, Hamilton decided. It's not worth it. Tomorrow, when it's daylight, I'll take care of it.
What happens,
Marcia asked,
if they all go out?
Good question, Hamilton admitted. I can't answer it. Then we try like hell, I guess, to find candles. Independent power sources like flashlights, cigarette lighters.
The poor insane thing,
Marcia murmured.
Just think, every time there's a blown-out power line, she sits in the dark waiting for the monsters to descend on her, thinking all the time that it's part of an elaborate plot.
Like we're thinking now,
McSafe said sourly.
But it is,
Law said.
This is her world. Here, when the lights go out.
In the darkness of the living room, the phone began to ring.
And that too, Hamilton said. What do you suppose she thinks when the phone rings? We better try to figure it out in advance. What does a ringing phone mean to a paranoiac?
I suppose it depends on the paranoiac,
Marcia answered.
Obviously, in this case, it's to lure her into the dark living room, so we won't go.
They waited. Presently, the phone ceased ringing. The seven of them began to breathe more easily.
We better stay here in the kitchen,
Laws said, turning around and starting back.
It won't hurt us. It's nice and cozy.
A sort of fortress, Hamilton said morbidly. When Marcia tried to put the second can of peaches into the refrigerator, the door refused to open. She stood holding the can foolishly, plucking at the inoperative handle until her husband came and gently urged her away.
"I'm just nervous," she murmured. "It's probably perfectly all right. It always sort of stuck." "Did anybody turn this toaster on?"
Mrs. Pritchett asked. On the little kitchen table, the toaster was humming away.
"It's as hot as a stove."
Hamilton came over and inspected it. After struggling futilely with the thermostat, he finally gave up and yanked out the cord. The heating element of the toaster faded into darkness.
"What can we trust?"
Mrs. Pritchett asked fearfully. "Nothing," Hamilton told her.
"It's so grotesque,"
Marcia protested. Thoughtfully, Laws opened the drawer by the sink.
"We may need protection."
He began rummaging through the silverware until he found what he wanted, a heavy-handled steel steak knife. As his fingers closed around it, Hamilton stepped forward and tugged his arm away.
"Be careful," he warned. "Remember the can of peaches."
"But we need this,"
Laws said irritably. Evading Hamilton, he snatched up the knife.
"I've got to have something. You've got that damn gum there bulging out like a brick."
For an instant, the knife lay resting in the palm of his hand. Then, with a determined squirm, it forced itself around, quivering skillfully, and plunged itself directly at the Negro's stomach. Agilely, Laws eluded it. The knife buried itself in the wooden panel of the sink. Quick as a flash, Laws raised his heavy shoe and tramped down on the handle. With a metallic tinkle, the handle broke off, leaving the severed blade embedded in the wood. There it remained, struggling uselessly.
"See," Hamilton said dryly.
Weak and fainting, Mrs. Pritchett sank down on a chair by the table.
"Oh, dear,"
she murmured.
"Whatever will we do?"
Her voice trailed off in an indistinct moan.
"Oh."
Quickly taking a glass from the drain board, Marcia reached for the water faucet.
"I'll get you a drink of cold water, Mrs. Pritchett."
But the fluid that poured from the tap wasn't water. It was warm, thick, red blood.
"The house,"
Marcia said faintly, shutting off the flow. In the white enamel sink, an ugly pool of blood sluggishly dribbled reluctantly down the drain.
"The house itself is alive."
"Absolutely," Hamilton agreed. "And we're inside it."
"I think we all agree," Arthur Sylvester said, "that we're going to have to get outdoors. The question is, can we?"
Going to the back door, Hamilton tried the bolt. It was firmly in place. Tugging with all his strength, he failed to budge it.
"Not that way," he answered.
"That always stuck,"
Marcia said.
"Let's try the front door." "But that means going through the living room,"
Laws pointed out.
"You have a better suggestion?"
"No,"
Laws conceded.
"Except that whatever we do, we better do it right away."
In single file, the seven of them moved cautiously through the dark hall toward the pool of blackness that was the living room. Hamilton led the procession. Realization that, after all, it was his house gave him a measure of courage. Perhaps, a dim hope, he could expect some special dispensation. From the furnace vent in the hall came a rhythmic wheezing. Halting, Hamilton stood listening. The air that billowed out was warm and fragrant. Not the dead, stale air of a mechanical appliance, but the personal, body-warmed breath generated by a living organism. Down in the basement, the furnace was breathing. Back and forth the air moved, as the house creature inhaled and exhaled.
"Is it male or female?"
Marcia asked.
"Male,"
McFaith said.
"Miss Rice is afraid of men."
The air that billowed out smelled pungently of cigar smoke, stale beer, and masculine perspiration. The tough composite odors that Miss Rice must have encountered on buses, in elevators, in restaurants. The harsh, garlic-laden scent of middle-aged men.
"That's probably how her boyfriend smells," Hamilton said, "when he breathes down her neck."
Marcia shuddered.
"And to come home and smell it all around her?"
Probably by now the electrical wiring of the house was a neurological system, carrying the nervous impulses of the house creature.
Why not?
The water pipes carried its blood, the furnace pipes carried air to its basement lungs. Through the living room window, Hamilton could make out the shape of the trailing ivy vines that Marcia had painstakingly induced to climb to the roof. In the night darkness, the ivy was no longer green. It was a dull brown. like hair, like the thick dandruff-clouded hair of a middle-aged businessman. The ivy blew slightly in the wind, an ominous shudder that sent bits of dirt and stem showering down to the lawn outside. Under Hamilton's feet, the floor stirred. At first, he failed to notice. It wasn't until Mrs. Pritchett began to wail that he identified the faint undulation. Bending down, he touched the asphalt tile with the palm of his hand. The tile was warm, like human flesh. The walls, too, were warm, and not hard, not the firm, unyielding surface of paint, paper, plaster, and wood, but a soft surface that gave slightly under his fingers.
"Come on," Law said tightly. "Let's move."
Warily, like trapped animals, the seven of them made their way forward into the darkness of the living room. Under their feet, the carpet stirred restlessly. They could hear it all around them, the uneasy living presence, rippling and fretting, struggling into irritable animation. It was a long trip across the dark living room. On all sides, lamps and books stirred sullenly. Once, Mrs. Pritchett gave a mindless squeak of terror. The cord of the television set had craftily wrapped itself around her ankle. Bill Laws, with a swift yank of his hand, snapped the cord and pulled her loose. Behind them, the severed cord lashed furiously, impotently.
"We're almost there," Hamilton said to the indistinct shapes behind him.
He could make out the door and the doorknob. Already he was reaching for it. Praying silently, he groped closer. 3 feet, 2 feet, only one single foot left. He seemed to be going uphill. Astonished, he drew his hand back. He was on a slant, a rising expanse of material down which he was already beginning to slide. Suddenly he was rolling and falling, arms flailing. He fought to get up. All seven of them slipped and bumped back toward the center of the living room, toward the hall itself. The hall was utterly dark. Even the kitchen light had gone off. There was only the dim flicker of stars beyond the windows, tiny spots of brilliance a long way off.
"It's the carpet,"
Bill Laws was saying in a muted, unbelieving whisper.
"It licked us back."
Under them, the carpet stirred violently. A warm, spongy surface, it was already becoming moist. Stumbling up, Hamilton collided with the wall and recoiled. The wall dripped a thick ooze of wetness, an avid, leaking sheet of anticipatory saliva. The house creature was getting ready to feed. Cringing against the wall, Hamilton tried to edge past the carpet. The tip of it reached cunningly around, groping for him as he advanced, sweating and trembling, toward the front door. One step, two, three, four. Behind him, other shapes came, but not all.
"Where's Edith Pritchett?" Hamilton demanded.
"Gone,"
Marcia said.
"Rolled back into the hall."
"The throat,"
Laws's voice came.
"We're in its mouth,"
David Pritchett said faintly. The warm, wet flesh of the creature's mouth billowed and pushed against Hamilton. The pressure of it sent shudders of revulsion through him. Struggling forward, he groped again for the doorknob, concentrating on the small orb of faintly glimmering metal. This time he managed to catch hold of it. With one great tug, he flung the door wide. The shapes behind him gasped as the night became abruptly visible. Stars, the street, dark houses on the far side, trees swaying in the uneven wind, and cold, crisp air. That was all. Without warning, the square outline began to fold up. The doorway became smaller as the walls squeezed it shut. Only a tiny slot remained, like lips. The walls had pressed together, closing it out of existence. From behind them, the garlicky, rancid breath of the creature billowed out of the hall. The tongue rippled greedily. The walls sweated saliva. In the gloom around Hamilton, human voices shrilled in hopeless fear. Ignoring them, he fought to get his hands and arms into the dwindling cavity that had been the front door. Beneath him, the floor began to rise, and the ceiling, slowly and inexorably, was coming down. With rhythmical precision, the two were coming together. In a moment, they would meet.
"Chewing,"
Marcia gasped, beside him in the darkness. Hamilton kicked with all his strength. Putting his shoulder against the compressed door, he shoved, fought, scratched, and tore at the soft flesh. Tatters of organic substance came away in his hands. Gouging, he dug away great gobs of it.
"Help me,"
he shouted to the shapes struggling around him. Bill Laws and Charlie McFaith rose up from the ooze of saliva and began tearing at the door in frenzy. An opening appeared. With Marcia and David Pritchett helping, they managed to tear a circular gap in the flesh.
"Out,"
Hamilton snarled, pushing his wife through. Marcia sprawled on the front porch and rolled away.
"You next,"
Hamilton said to Sylvester. The old man was shoved roughly through. After him came Laws and then McFaith. Flaring around, Hamilton saw no other shapes but himself and David Pritchett. The ceiling and floor had virtually met. There was no time to worry about anybody else.
"Get through there,"
he grunted, and heaved the boy bodily through the palpitating gap. Then, twisting and shuddering, he got himself through. Behind, within the mouth of the creature, the ceiling and floor came together. A sharp crunch was audible as hard surfaces met. Again and again the crunching sound came. Mrs. Pritchett, who had not gotten out, was being chewed up. The surviving members of the group collected in the front yard, safely away from the house. None of them spoke as they stood watching the creature methodically contract and expand. Digestive processes were taking place. Finally, the movement ebbed away. A last ripple of spasmodic activity passed through it, and then the creature was silent. With a dull whir, the window shades came down, forming opaque shadows that remained in place.
"It's sleeping,"
Marcia said distantly. Idly, Hamilton wondered what the garbage men would say when they came to pick up the garbage. A neat heap of bones would lie resting on the back porch, a glistening pile that would have been expertly picked, sucked, and then cast out, and perhaps a few buttons and metal hooks.
"That's that,"
Laws observed. Hamilton started toward the car.
"It's going to be a real pleasure to kill her," he stated.
"Not the car,"
Laws warned.
"We can't trust it."
Halting, Hamilton considered.
"We'll go over to her apartment on foot. I'll try to get her to come outside, if we can catch her in the open without going indoors."
"She's probably already outdoors,"
Marcia said.
"This would be working against her, too. Maybe she's already dead. Maybe her apartment house devoured her as soon as she went inside."
"She's not dead,"
Laws pointed out sardonically,
"or we wouldn't still be here."
From the dark shadows by the garage, a slim shape emerged.
"That's right,"
it said, in a quiet, colorless voice, a familiar voice.
"I'm still alive."
From his coat pocket, Hamilton got the .45. As his fingers probed for the safety catch, a bizarre realization came to him. He had never in his life used the gun before, or even seen it. In the real world, he owned no .45. The gun had appeared with Miss Rice's world. It was part of his personality and existence in this feral pathological fantasy.
"You escaped?"
Bill Laws asked Miss Rice.
"I was wise enough not to go upstairs,"
the woman's answer came.
"I realized what you had planned as soon as I set foot on the lobby carpet."
There was a touch of frantic triumph in Miss Rice's voice.
"You're not as clever as you thought." "My God," Marcia said, "but we never..." "You're going to try to kill me, aren't you?"
Miss Rice inquired.
"All of you, the whole group. You've been conspiring for some time, haven't you?"
"That's true,"
Laws admitted suddenly.
"It really is."
Harshly, metallically, Miss Rice laughed.
"I knew it. And you're not afraid to come right out and say it, are you?"
"Miss Rice," Hamilton said, "of course we're conspiring to kill you, but we can't. There isn't a human being in this insane world that could lay a finger on you. It's these horrors you've dreamed up that..."
"But,"
Miss Rice broke in,
"you're not human beings."
"What?"
Arthur Sylvester demanded.
"Of course not. I knew that when I first saw you that day at the Bevatron. That's why you all survived the fall. It was an obvious attempt to get me out of there and push me to my death, but I didn't die."
Miss Rice smiled.
"I have a few resources of my own."
Very slowly, Hamilton said,
"If we're not human beings, then what are we?"
At that moment, Bill Laws stirred. Whirring up from the moist grass, he glided directly toward the small, thin shape of Joan Rice. Unfolded wings, dusty and parchment-like, flapped and rustled in the night gloom. His aim was absolutely correct. He was on top of her before she could move or cry out. What had seemed to be a human being was a multi-jointed chitinous entity that buzzed and fluttered as it folded itself around Miss Rice's feebly protesting body. The elongated rear portion of the creature twisted. With a sharp jab, it stung the woman, held its poisonous tail deep in her body for an interval, and then, satiated, withdrew. Gradually, the creature's clawking, scrabbling claws released her. Swaying, Miss Rice hitched onto her hands and knees and lay stunned, face down and gasping in the wet grass.
"She'll crawl away,"
Arthur Sylvester said quickly. Running forward, he sprang on the shrinking body and turned it over. Rapidly, efficiently, he squirted quick-drying cement in a continuous trail around the woman's bony hips. Revolving her, he wound her tightly in a thick net of tough fibers. When he had finished, the elongated insect that had been Bill Laws grappled her up in his claws. Supporting the feebly quivering cocoon, he held it in place while Sylvester spun a long strand and tossed it over the limb of a tree. In a moment, the half-paralyzed shape of Joan Rice hung head downward in her sack of gummy webs, eyes glazed, mouth half open, swaying slightly with the night wind.
"That should hold her," Hamilton said with satisfaction.
"I'm glad you kept her alive," Marcia said avidly. "We can take our time with her. There's nothing she can do."
"But we've got to kill her eventually," McSafe pointed out. "After we have our pleasure."
"She killed my mother,"
David Pritchett said in a small vibrating voice. Before any of them could catch him, he sprinted forward, crouched, and leaped up onto the swaying cocoon. Extending a protruding feeding tube, he pushed aside the strands of the cocoon, tore away the woman's dress, and greedily drilled into her pale flesh. Very shortly, he had probed deep into the moistures of her body. After a time, he dropped back to the ground, bloated and dizzy, leaving behind him a withered, dehydrated husk. The husk was still alive, but it was dying rapidly. Pain-blurred eyes gazed sightlessly down at them. Joan Rice was past comprehension. Only a vague, dull spark of personality remained. The members of the group watched appreciatively, conscious that the final seconds of her agony were drifting away.
"She deserved it," Hamilton said hesitantly.
Now that the job had been accomplished, he was beginning to have doubt. Beside him, the tall, multi-pointed chitinous insect that was Bill Laws nodded in agreement.
"Of course she did."
His voice was a thin, buzzing rasp.
"Look what she did to Edith Pritchett."
"It'll be good to get out of this world," Marcia said. "Back to our own world."
"And our own shapes," Hamilton added with an uneasy glance at Arthur Sylvester.
"What do you mean?"
Laws demanded.
"He doesn't understand,"
Sylvester said with a trace of cold amusement.
"These are our shapes, Hamilton, but they haven't appeared before,"
he added.
"At least not where you could see them."
Laws laughed brittly.
"Listen to him. Listen to what he thinks. Hamilton, you're so very interesting."
"Maybe we should see what else he thinks,"
Arthur Sylvester suggested.
"Let's watch him,"
Laws agreed.
"Let's get up close where we can see what he has to say. Let's find out what he can do."
Aghast, Hamilton said,
"Kill her and let's end this. You're part of her insanity and you don't know it."
"I wonder how fast he can run,"
Arthur Sylvester conjectured, slowly approaching Hamilton.
"Keep away from me,"
Hamilton said, reaching for his gun.
"And his wife,"
Sylvester said.
"Let's give her a go-around, too."
"I want her,"
David Pritchett said greedily.
"Let me have her. You can hold her for me if you want. You can keep her from trying to..."
Hanging silently in her cocoon, Miss Rice quietly died. And without a sound, the world around them expired into random particles. Weak with relief, Hamilton pulled the dim shape of his wife to him and stood holding her.
"Thank God,"
he said.
"We're out of there."
Marcia hung on tight to him.
"It was just in time, wasn't it?"
Swirling shadows drifted around them. Patiently, Hamilton stood waiting. There was going to be pain ahead as they emerged on the litter-strewn concrete floor of the Bevatron. All of them were injured. There would be a period of suffering and slow recovery, long empty days in the hospital. But it would be worth it. Well worth it. The shadows cleared. They were not in the Bevatron.
"Here we go again,"
Charlie McFaith said heavily. He rose from the moist lawn and stood gripping the porch railing.
"But it can't be,"
Hamilton said stupidly.
"There aren't any left. We've been through all of them."
"You're wrong,"
McFaith said.
"Sorry, Jack, but I told you. I warned you about her and you wouldn't listen."
Parked at the curb in front of Hamilton's house was an ominous black car. The doors had been pushed open. From the back seat stepped a vast, waddling figure that stalked rapidly across the dark yard and up to Hamilton. Behind it came hulking, grim-faced men in overcoats and hats, hands thrust menacingly in their pockets.
"There you are," the corpulent man grunted. "Okay, Hamilton, come along."
At first, Hamilton didn't recognize them. The man's face was a mass of doughy flesh, corrupted by a weak chin and ugly little eyes set deep in the fat. His fingers, as they closed roughly over Hamilton's arm, were fleshy talons. He gave off a foul odor of rancid but expensive cologne and blood.
"Why weren't you at work today?"
the heavy-set man grunted.
"I'm sorry for you, Jack. I knew your father."
"We found out about the picnic,"
one of his company toughs added.
"Tillingford,"
Hamilton said, dazed. "Is it really you?" With an ugly leer, Dr. Guy Tillingford, the bloated, blood-smeared capitalist, turned and shambled back toward his parked Cadillac.
"Bring him along,"
he ordered his gang of men.
"I have to get back to the Epidemic Development Agency labs. We've got some new bacterial poisons we want to try. You'll make a good subject."